This is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox in for Farai today. On today's roundtable, poverty. It's moving into the suburbs. Texas becomes the first state to require sixth grade girls to be vaccinated against the papillomavirus. And in New York City, some activists want the police to stop stopping folks. Joining us today are Michael Myers, executive director of the New York Civil Rights Coalition, Laura Washington, Chicago Sun-Times columnist, and Jeff Obafemi Carr, host of the radio show Freestyle. Hello, everybody. Nice to have you with us.
Hi, Tony.
Hey, Tony.
Okay. A little confused earlier there with Julianne. You know, she's normally on our roundtable segment, and we had her in a different place today. So I'm glad to have you guys with us on roundtable. I know where we are now. Let's talk about poverty in the suburbs to begin with. More of America's poor are living in the suburbs than ever before. A survey from the Brookings Institute reveals over a million more people living outside the city limits and living below the poverty line have pushed the suburbs to a tipping point. Now, 38 million Americans all told live below that poverty line, and that's defined as $20,000 a year in annual income for a family of four. Now, it seems to be a regional problem, this suburban poverty, affecting areas mostly in the South and in the Mideast. Cities like Cleveland, Detroit, Dallas are struggling amid the loss of manufacturing jobs. But unemployment, Mike Myers, seems to be the key reason for the increase. Are you surprised to hear this, that this is going on?
No, because after so much time trying to zone poor people out of the suburbs, it's ironic that poverty now ensnares the once middle class who relocated to the suburbs in order to escape poverty and to escape with the environment of poor people being around them. I think the suburban life is a costly lifestyle. It is one that where you have mortgages and property taxes and heating costs. You got to get into a car in order to go to a supermarket. And usually there are two-car families, which means more money for oil and gas. It is a situation where it is a very expensive lifestyle. And if you happen to lose your job in a two-job family, you become like other folks who lose their jobs. You become poor. You can't afford your lifestyle anymore. Mm-hmm. You borrow. You go with the credit cards. You're in trouble.
Well, you know, he's right, Laura Washington. People, when they moved to the burbs, they had jobs. But when they got out there and they lost them, they found themselves stuck.
And, well, Tony, and you know there's a very social-cultural reason behind this move to the suburbs, which, incidentally, I know you know, didn't start in the last few years with this survey covered. There's always this, I think, myth that the picket fences and the two-car garages and the grassy lawns are nirvana. And so you saw a lot of folks from the central cities, cities like Chicago, for example, cities like Detroit, cities like Cleveland, move to these communities in some ways, not just for a quote-unquote better life, but to escape what they saw as urban ills, and in particular, increasing people, populations of color in these cities. So they found out that it's not quite that simple. There have been some poverty in suburbs, especially I know as best the Chicago suburbs, for decades. And part of that poverty comes from poor people being pushed out because of gentrification. The central cities that are thriving now, cities like Chicago, are forcing middle income and even working class people to look elsewhere for housing because they can't afford the housing in central cities. And that's why they're ending up out there. Julianne mentioned earlier the cuts in low-income housing. I think that's another factor here. There's been a retrenchment in terms of funding for public housing under the Bush administration, even starting before that. And so many of the poor folks that used to be able to have a lifeline in public housing are being forced out into the suburbs on vouchers.
So, Jeff, do you think that these folks are going to be pushed even farther out, or will they return to the city?
I think they're going to be pushed even farther out, or at least to defer to something Michael said earlier, they're going to be zoned. There are going to be places where there's going to be zones for subsidized housing, for scattered housing. Laura made a great point when she talked about gentrification. I found myself stuck on a stretch of Interstate 24 in a neighborhood here that used to be considered a very posh suburb. And when gentrification started taking place in the inner city ring, really on a heavy basis about 5 years ago, all of a sudden you had a lot of cheap and affordable housing in this particular area. A lot of African Americans started purchasing property there, and they started because of the myth that you have to have a house and a couple of cars sitting out there. One of the points to recognize is that some of the people who go out to the suburbs can't really afford to go out to the suburbs, but they go out and they chase that family dream. So now, in essence, with programs like Hope 6 that take public housing and tear them down, rebuild a certain percentage of those units into nice homes, and then scatter everything else out, you end up having poverty out there in the suburbs. There's a embarrassment factor also at work here. Because of various things, you call it keeping up with the Joneses or whatever you like, people will go deeper into the very debt that will contribute to even deeper poverty just to keep up the image that they're doing okay here. So I think that those factors will continue to contribute to this poverty in the suburbs, whether it's the issues I mentioned, whether it's some subsidized housing now being scattered into some of those suburbs. And when you talk about doing that, you talk about not having access to things that you have in a quote, end quote, inner city loop. Transportation that's irregular, supermarkets and other stores not being in walking distance. Those kind of things will really contribute to harder times for the poor.
I want to hit one more point before we move on to our next topic, but let me just stop and say this. If you are just joining us, you are listening to NPR's News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox, and we're on the roundtable, and we are talking at the moment about poverty in the suburbs. And our panelists include Michael Myers, Executive Director of the New York Civil Rights Coalition, Laura Washington, a Chicago Sun-Times columnist, and who you just heard, Jeff Obafemi Carr, host of the radio show Freestyle. Here's my question, folks, one more. How do these communities in the suburbs, these cities that are out there now, how do they respond to the issue of poverty? We know how the urban areas are trying to cope with it, but how do these small enclaves deal with it?
Well, what you're seeing is that the suburban areas becoming like urban areas. When urban areas become poor, the schools get run down. You're going to have the need for social services, subsidies, public welfare. And that's what's going to happen in the suburbs, in many suburbs already. You have people who depend on social services or trying to get the use of public transportation. And I know day workers who live in the suburbs who are doubled up, multipled up in terms of housing, but also those who travel there through public transportation, which is not very good and not very frequent and not very regular, but that's how they get there, and that's how they get out of there. Mm-hmm. So you're gonna have these suburban areas, particularly the segregated suburban areas, because you see that happening too. Blacks are not just going to the suburbs, they're being segregated in the suburbs. So exurbia becomes whiter, suburbs become blacker and browner and poorer.
Go ahead, Laura.
Tony, I think that the suburbs are going to have to get politically organized as much as lobbies for working class and the poor have been in the city. There's some discussion about the fact that the Congress is likely to raise the minimum wage under this new Democratic leadership, and I think that's just a Band-Aid approach. Raising minimum wage to $7.25 in the next couple of years is not going to solve this problem, but getting politically organized, especially in a period when we're in the midst of a presidential campaign where we have at least one candidate, John Edwards, and possibly someone like Al Sharpton, who made the working poor and the plight of the working poor parts of their platforms. There needs to be some impetus coming out of the suburbs, and it needs to come from groups that represent these folks, because the political leadership in mostly suburbs you can't make generalizations, but it tends to be more politically conservative and less open to entitlements and other kinds of federal aid. You need to find ways to tap those people and get those people's attention, especially at this time when politics is such a big, important issue right now.
All right, let's move on to topic number two that we have for today. Texas Governor Rick Perry signed an order requiring schoolgirls to be vaccinated against the sexually transmitted virus that causes cervical cancer. Now, it is the first state to make the vaccination mandatory, and the executive order made by the governor, who is a Republican conservative, puts him squarely at odds with people who fear the law condones sex for girls 11 and 12 years old. So let's talk about the opposition for a moment. And Laura, I'm going to come to you first. Mm-hmm. There seem to be two tracks here of opposition. One, the issue of parental rights, and secondly, the issue of condoning premarital sex.
Well, here we go with that sex again. That's always that's a conversation killer. I think sex
is a sexy subject.
Yeah, come on. All of us, you know, some of us are a little younger than others, but all of us remember when we were in sixth grade and we were that age, there were sexually active children at that age, like it or not. I think partly that the reason for that is some of the same parents that are screaming no about this policy, and I happen to think this is an excellent, important policy, or the same folks that are not engaging their children in talk about safe sex and protecting their sexual health. So young people, girls and boys, get sexually active, and you need to be able to find a way to protect them against yourself. This shouldn't be allowed to become a political football, which is exactly what's happening in Texas. You know, folks saying, you know, that they should be able to have the right to protect their children from a vaccine that might encourage them to be sexually active. That's just nonsensical. And I think that it's really, you know, they really don't want to have the conversation about sex and the importance of being able to protect kids.
Isn't this more complicated than that, Jeff? Because it involves, you know, if you have a daughter who is a sixth grader, subjecting her to this kind of treatment and all sorts of issues that particularly the black community has with regard to the medical establishment.
I have a 12-year-old daughter who's in the sixth grade. If I was living in Texas, I would be dealing with this particular issue. But even though I'm not living there, I am still dealing with the notion of how we relate to our children and how we also protect our children, too. In terms of vaccination, there's some people who do not opt for vaccination. When my daughter was a young, very healthy child, we opted not to get certain vaccinations because of the lack of empirical proof that some of them were effective. Mm-hmm. Now that I'm facing her at that age in the middle school environment, I have to think about this particular issue because HPV is wreaking havoc, especially in the black community. But I think that it should, of course, still be an option that's available, and it should be a parental decision. I don't think that it sends a message that sex is okay. That message comes from responsible parents and whether or not they communicate effectively with their kids. $360 a pop is what this Gardasil shot is going to cost for a 3-shot treatment. And you times half or more of the U.S. population, 12 and under, and that's what it's all about. This could generate billions of dollars for Merck. I personally wouldn't do it at this stage because we can't really judge the super long-term effects of the vaccine. But I think that this is handled with conversations with kids and their parents and the relationship that they have. And we can't depend upon whether or not a person gets a shot to determine whether or not our children will make the choice to have sex.
Well, Micah, before you jump in, I want to just follow one thing up with Jeff, if I may. And if it's too personal, just say so. Would you discuss this with your 12-year-old?
Yes, I've discussed it with her since she was 10 or 11. And the reason why is because when you talk to your kids or you talk to other kids or you spend time around kids, as I do from time to time, the kids are talking about it anyway. So I would much rather be the person that she talks to about issues of sex, sexuality, health and hygiene than some other kid who's sitting in the locker room or sitting across the table from her who may not have the same kind of relationship with their parents but thinks they know it all because they watch MTV.
Interesting point. Go ahead, Mike.
Well, my view is that there's no public health emergency that's been declared in Texas, and yet you have the governor passing through an executive order over or bypassing the legislature. That's an interesting issue only because, you know, except indeed, there is an opt-out on by parents, by the way, so it's less of a problem because you can opt out on religious or philosophical grounds. But there's a problem here because of the appearance with respect to Merck and Merck bankrolling this in Texas and trying to get the same kind of laws or executive orders passed in other states. Now, I have to make a disclosure. I have Merck stock. Merck stock is not doing very well, by the way. So this could help. This could benefit me. But at the same time, I must say that these mandated inoculations, when there is no public health emergency, and to the possibility that it might bypass parental options or opt out, that's a real concern. But let's talk about aggressive policing.
All right, that is our last topic, and we've got about a couple of minutes or so to hit it. And I think it's one that we should talk about. We have always well, not always, but many of us have talked about being stopped while black, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And now in the city of New York, there is a groundswell of resistance apparently against the police because officers, again, apparently in that city, are stopping and frisking more people than ever before, more than a half million more than a year ago, and people are starting to complain about it. Since you live there, Mike Myers, how bad is it?
Well, it's worse than it is, as it appears. The constant complaint has been that young blacks, in particular, and young Hispanics, wherever they sit, wherever they walk, wherever they stand, wherever they drive, they're stopped by police. It is a problem with NYPD being in denial because it's up to 508,000 plus individuals being stopped last year. But that's in comparison to 2002. So NYPD, despite the law and requirements of reporting to the city council, stop and frisk by racial data, has not done it. And we have a Commissioner Kelly who has his head in the sand with denial, claiming that, well, the only way blacks are being stopped is because blacks are predominantly those who are involved in crime or suspects. Now, that's racial profiling. Mm-hmm. You have to have specific basis for stopping people or suspicion of a crime about to happen or has happened. And the politicians in this city, the public officials in this city, have keep denying the problem and covering up the problem, and when faced with the problem, trying to say, well, it's not really as you say it is. Well, it is.
Well, you know what we need to do? We really need to address this again at a time when we have more time because our day's time allotment has run short, but this is an important topic, and I think that a lot of black people, especially in different parts of the country, anyone who has ever been stopped by the police knows what that feels like. So we will look at it again. But for today, let me just say thank you to our New York Bureau, where Mike Myers, Executive Director of the New York Civil Rights Coalition, joined us. Jeff Obafemi Carr, host of the radio show Freestyle. It's at Spotland Production in Nashville, Tennessee. And Laura Washington, Chicago Sun-Times columnist, is at our Chicago Bureau. Everybody, thank you once again.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tony.
From you, Tony.